The theme for the afternoon talk is the exploration of change. If I may say, quite some time ago, when I was in my early 20s, it was the time of the hippie culture. Love, peace and harmony. And as my daughter tells me, if you haven't changed, you're still a hippie. And I, as some small percentage of us who are hippies, in this case from leaving England, continental Europe, making the overland journey to what was the hippie Mecca called India. Mecca, my God, never. Anyway, so, and this is in April, May of 1967 for myself, which came to be called in Europe the Summer of Love. I don't remember it. And while making the journey, I was on my way here to Israel. But June 67 didn't seem quite the best month to come. So I bypassed and instead travelled through Turkey instead of coming south, carried on and into Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal and onwards. And I must say, my recollections of that journey are very fond and happy memories, and particularly of the exceptional warmth and hospitality of the Arab and Muslim culture. And there are still occasionally a number of Westerners who make the overland journey to India, by the way. And one of the guys turned up in Bodh Gaya in our retreat on his bicycle. And I asked him, where'd you get your bike? And he said, Amsterdam. And I said, well, you cycled? He said, yeah, all the way. And I said, but you're Dutch. You know, you're in NATO. You've got troops in Afghanistan or in Iraq and all these, and in the Arab world. And he said he made the journey through Turkey, Iran, pedaled down to southern Iran, skipped Afghanistan and crossed from Iran into Afghanistan. You can do it down the bottom end of it there. So I said to him, how was the hospitality? He said, I don't remember paying for a meal or for staying in a guest house. He said it was absolutely extraordinary. And I was very touched, and I think it's always so important and a brief reminder to all of us, in fact, that we need to be able to distinguish governments and the military and their policies from people. And the kindness and hospitality of people, just as I receive every year when I come here, matters far more than the kind of ideologies which are so harmful for people everywhere. And in making this journey, the point I want to come to, besides giving you a reminder of how much hospitality has in common, is I arrived in Saranath, which I still actually go to every year, and I went into a small temple there. And this village of Saranath is where the Buddha gave his first teachings. We're talking 2,600 years ago. And I picked up a couple of small Buddhist books. And I already had some interest. And sometimes we pick up something and there is a certain kind of receptivity. And there is in the moment, and this is important, there is in the moment an event which takes place, which one didn't plan, didn't choose, nor organize, but it has an impact. And the impact of that strikes one, you know, as a kind of truth. And in striking one, it has an impact which sets up waves and actually sets up directions for one's life. And this capacity to meet something and be touched, in this case the book, but much else as well. And this was one of those moments or one of those days. And in these two little booklets, which I still actually have at home, two things stood out for me. Nothing very, you know, profound on face value. One was the statement frequently said, probably one of the most famous associated with the Buddha and the tradition, that all things are in a process of change. It's been hammered home, it's been repeated ad nauseum, it's been stated in every probably Buddhist talk for the last 2,600 years. It will go on long after I've become some ashes on some funeral pyre somewhere. And it's worth sometimes restating, and I want to look into that with you. The second, which actually supports and reminds and confirms the significance there, this is the one line: because everything is changing, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging and holding on to. Because everything is changing, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging and holding on to. And that sentence, of course, I'm on the road. I've been hitchhiking through 20, 30 countries, living out of the backpack. And of course, each day is a fresh and new day, in those years of being on the road. And so it had an immediate experiential relevance. It touched the spot. And I could see the simple truth of it. And there were the consequences or the effects that roll on. What I'd like to do to explore this a little bit further with you this afternoon, go a little bit more deeply into it. If we look at the larger scale of what it is to be on this earth, and as our fine scientists keep reminding us, that this whole movement or evolution or process of life, I don't think, well, it doesn't actually interest me, but I don't think it's particularly significant whether one has views and opinions about God the Creator, or one has views and opinions about Big Bang Theory or whatever. I'll leave the religious scientific wallers to speculate about all that. I think far more importantly is that we can say, and we can look and observe for ourselves without the external authority, that here is this life moving on in extraordinary and diverse ways, and all the changes and dynamics, changes, remember, that we see and experience. And what we see and notice in all of this, and this is one of the important things, for something to arise in this moment, something has to go. It could not obviously be possible for everything to keep arising. Can you imagine how crowded it would be? Bad enough as it is. So when we look at the process of life, when something arises, means something else is giving way to it. You've been sitting here for a few hours or and since yesterday, and in the meditations, as a confirmation of this, of course, for some experience to arise, it means that other experiences cannot be present. It is not possible to jam it all together. You may think so, but trust me, and sometimes there may be one, because it's never a heaven of a lot, so there may be one hell of a lot which is going on in inside. One actually thinks one is being beaten up and assaulted and harassed and mercilessly punched to death by one's own mind, which is a slight bizarre phenomena. And all of that is going on inside, and thinks, oh my God, there's an explosion of volcanic activity all going on. Everything's going on inside of me. not everything. What consciousness in the inner life can accommodate and can deal with in the moment or in the hour, actually is quite limited. And the inner universe, shall we call it, the inner world, is as vast, as deep, certainly as profound, as extraordinary a universe or a world as that one which the eyes and the ears look out on. That the potential for discovery in the depths, and they are vast, of the being is equally in terms of its potential as we can discover what is out there. And therefore, to repeat what I said, for something to arise, something must give way for something to arise. All right. So the question is, what does it mean to give way here? To give way, something has to drop away. Things have to make way for something new to begin. So you and I could reflect and give consideration to the many things in our life which arise and which give way to. But it's not what arises, just arises and hangs in forever. It arises. Just think of your day to day. How much has arisen today? How much has not arisen today because of what has arisen already? But what arises, it stays for a while may be a moment, or successive moments, or it might seem stuck and longer there. And so its registration will pass. And you and I cannot, in all experience, think of a single exception to this. It's not like I'm making it up. It's not like because Sid, I call him Sid, Siddhartha Gautama. It's not like, oh, he says, oh, it must be true. The voice of experience tells me this. The voice of experience tells me that everything which I have experienced has, so to speak, an arising to it. It has a staying power, shorter or longer, to it. And it will give way. It will pass away. And in its passing, it will give rise to something else. And it's the only way that life can move. It's the only way there can be an evolution, a movement of life. It's the only way there can be a dynamic activity from one day or one week or one year. Just in your, my presence here, we are able to be here because we arrive here because we've given up, obviously, being somewhere else. It doesn't take too much intelligence, does it? But human beings, in this vast unfolding and sometimes unfathomable movement, the great sin, S-I-N here, the great metaphoral, not judgmental here, the great sin of life is we forget. We forget. Oh my God, we forget. No God, we forget. And we forget the arising, the temporary staying, and its passing. And so a core feature of the teachings is, please, please remember this. Please reflect on this every day, you might say, of our life, so that we realize if we hold on to anything whatsoever, which is arising or staying or passing, it is going to be a problem. It's going to be an issue. You and I cannot think, at least I can't, if you come up with something, it'd be a miracle, but let me know. I We cannot think of a situation in life which, in which any stress, unhappiness, problem or issue isn't in some way or other connected with either what is arising, what is staying, or what is going. If you can come up with an issue in life which has no relation whatsoever to what is arising, staying, and going, I will become your disciple. So here's this phenomenal event, which you, we are, someone will come up with something and I'll be in trouble anyway. There is this phenomenal event which we are participating in, this great movement, and we find ourselves, we small human creatures, born into this great event called life, called the movement of life. So we've arisen into this world. We didn't, nobody asked to be born. We weren't out there somewhere and we say, well, I think I'll have those parents down there. Most of us, as I've said here regularly enough, we would, most of us would, I would never have chosen the parents we got. Etc. No wonder the Buddhists keep going on about, God, I must have done some bad karma in my past life, whatever. Look, I'm teasing here. So here we are, we find, wicked, we find us, anyway, we find us, I won't be sending this recording to my mother, by the way, 94 and still wanting me to get a proper job. You won't get a pension, you know. It's a bit late for a pension. Goodness me. She says the worst thing about being 94 is knowing that you've got a 70-year-old son. This is the worst thing about being 94. Etc. I didn't tell her what I thought the worst thing about being 70 was. But anyway. So, wicked, wicked. So there... There is this arising, there is the staying, and there is the passing. And a human being in our communication and our relationship to life has, every day of our life, a relationship to this. It isn't easy to be a free human being, which a liberated human being, which is essentially to be able to move freely in a liberated way with what arises, stays, and passes. That is what liberation is all about. There's something deathless about it, which I'll speak to another day. So therefore, I want to look at, and I want to see in my life as a human being, what is it that arises for me, which I find I'm either caught up in, I'm stuck in, I have multiple views and opinions about, and in some way or other, I kind of exaggerate its arising. And my thought is the tendency to do that. So something may arise in one's life, and that may be pleasure or painful or somewhere in between. It has an impact on us. Plenty of things in life genuinely are worthy of thought, genuinely are worthy of reflection. And that which touches us, it may be our heart, our feelings, it may be our experience, our thought, maybe our love and our concern and our compassion and empathy. And it touches us. And we feel the experience of it in the consciousness, just as much as the fear and the blame and the reactivity. And it isn't easy to know what is the wise and skillful amount of thought that I need to give to what is arising. And if I don't have that wisdom and clarity, I'm in trouble. If I don't have the wisdom and clarity, I might ignore that. I might say to myself, I don't want to think about it. I don't want a single thought about it. I might tell another or tell myself. I might make myself so busy in the refusal to think about and reflect on something, that it gets stuck inside of us, so to speak. And the consequences of that is hidden impacts. We don't feel happy. We have a feeling that issues are really unresolved inside of us. There's a real tension going on. And partly because we've run away from working with something. But the other extreme as well, apart from the denial, is excessive thinking. And that excessive thinking is just as painful, and it causes just as much anguish for us in direct ways. And that may show itself, something is important. It has arisen for us, and you and I, we can think of what these issues might be. We start thinking about that, him, her, job, work, past, present, future, country, society, culture, me, my experiences, whatever. And we start thinking about that. And sometimes, as the thinking gets excessive, the Buddha uses a strong word, he calls it papancha. It's the proliferation. It means too much thinking about. And when we keep thinking about, whatever it might be, positive or negative, the outcome of it is that the thought begins to hide. We actually stop actually seeing what the event is about. And what we actually left with is the thoughts about. And the thoughts, as the thinking increases, gets further and further removed from the actual event. And we've become so identified with the thoughts, and equally, we've become so deluded, because we are thinking about the issue. We are not. We are thinking. The name of the issue, the storyline, is got further and further away. And we're in this terrible spell of thought. And we're spellbound, we are enchanted with it, we are obsessed with it, and the deluded core thought is, if I keep on thinking about this long enough, I'll get to an answer. Oh, no you won't. You'll get yourself into a bloody mess. There'd be confusion and indecision and conflict and anguish. So it's not easy to find some kind of middle ground, and the middle way, of course, a key feature of the teaching, from the one of rejection and denial, I'm not going to think about this, that kind of pressure we have on ourselves. And the other one, imagining if I keep thinking that and continue with that, it will get clear. It will be a loop. We'll go round and round and round, and then we'll go and talk with others, and they come out with that dreadful one-liner. It makes me squirm when I hear it, when the person starts off their sentence with, "If I were you." You are not that person. If I were you, I would. I bet they wouldn't. They say, "If I were you." There. And so then, the good person, even our best, not talking about our mother here, even our best friends, you see. And then they come up with some different ideas, and they had different thoughts. Those thoughts may help, but those thoughts may, oh yeah. So now one was thinking two or three things one might do or not do. Now one's got a few more things. They guarantee sleepless nights. So this inner work, amongst the many aspects of it, gives attention to the wise use of thought. We need to know ourselves, to know clearly how much thought is applicable, and to have the great power of the mind to be able to, and it's part of our meditation process, that when we say, this is enough thought, there is the power of the mind that it stops. Not because it's repressed, not because there's denial taking place, but there is enough mindfulness, enough quiet, calm concentration, and enough clear comprehension to say inwardly to the whole spectrum of thought, enough is enough. And that response to that, if it has the support of understanding, thought becomes quiet. And then thought in life, reflective thought here, actually serves a human being as a friend. Not to oppress us, not to make our life difficult, but a useful aid and support in life for what is necessary. Not an easy task, as I mentioned, to find the middle way here. I can just tell a personal story for a moment or two. I have a daughter who I absolutely love to bits, and it would be very rare that she doesn't get a mention on the retreats there. Some of my friends who've been sitting with me at retreats for years, if not decades, and my daughter is now 33, said, "We know your entire life story of your daughter because of your talks." So sometimes there are the events. So as I mentioned, there's the event. The small event is a precious moment as a catalyst sometimes for insight, for understanding, for change. So the event which took place in August is that my darling daughter got married. I found it rather amusing because her mother, who lives a few minutes walk away, has never been married. I have never been married. And when my daughter said that she's going to get married, to be honest, the first thought that came up in my mind was, you know, what did we do wrong? But anyway. Apologies for those of you who are married. And it's an extraordinary function. It relates a little bit to the talk here. That there's this rather strange and another deluded idea in what is present in life. So I say, oh, my daughter and is present in my life, but in this kind of worn out, what do you call it? The best tradition from the prehistoric period, which still lingers around. It's called patriarchy, and in this strange thing of marriage, there. Some of you will know, and I'm sure, much similarities in the Judeo-Christian tradition and other traditions as well, that the view was, and still is, even in the language, one owns this person, in this case the woman. She's not the possession of the mother and father, it's the possession of the father there. So my daughter decided she wanted to get married in the church, which was equally upsetting. And she's never, honestly, I don't think she's ever been in a church in her whole life, etc. So she wants to get married. She wants to get married in a church, and she was wearing kind of ivory colours rather than white because, you know, it's just not quite a virgin. After she got pregnant the third time, I said to her, "Darling," I said to her, "a man has only got to sneeze in front of you and you get pregnant." So the priest, who's, you know, kind of a nice, sweet man, I think, So there was this marriage ceremony, and she's marrying this fantastic guy, this Caribbean guy. She's my daughter. Long ago, completely gave up on us whiteys. She just thinks the whiteys are so uncool, etc. So she's the man of the Caribbean guy, and he's really cool. I have to must say. And when we get to the altar. So I have to give her away. See, she's mine. It's a possession. She's my present. Now I have to give her away. And just before that, I mean, a few months before, I've tried to keep the story. No, it won't. Short, but anyway. And he rang me up just to show this madness of possession and ownership and having. He rang me up and he said, Christopher, I love Nashawna. That's my daughter. It's an American Indian word. So I love you. Really, I want her hand in marriage. He rang me up and asked. So I said the obvious thing, which hand? Left or right? Yeah, I was taking the piss, you know. And I said, what about the whole person? Would you? They said, yeah, of course, yeah, the whole person. And so there, he rings me up. And then she's my possession, I give her over to him. This patriarchal system. I said, well, since she's my possession, the father's daughter, I hand her over to you. That's my possession, I'm giving to you. I said, will you be paying me by cash or credit card? Just to get the point across, you know, we had some good humour out of it there. And so at the actual service itself, we're standing there, and the priest turns to me, and he said, do you hand Nashawna over to Dean, that's the guy she's married, do you hand her over? Well, suppose so, etc. And so then she goes over to him, and then it's his possession. I think, you know, am I living in the 21st century or in 10,000 years ago? This language of this, of course, the way they made the wedding, and they also see the funny, crazy side of it. So a holding mind, I use it, it's long-winded, forgive me. A holding mind. Is it possible to see what arises, stays, and passes there, in which one recognizes it as, shall we call it, a truth of life, appreciates events, the beautiful event, the marriage, fabulous day. I have actually proposed twice in my life. I should get this in it. I got turned down both times, etc. But fairly obvious why, isn't it? Anyway, so there is the arising and the staying and the passing. Can I, to come back, have a relationship to life in which I'm respectful of that? I see that it's common for all of us. And that there is the arising, the staying, and the passing. And my relationship to it is one which is of not holding to it, not holding on. Because the holding on, the possessiveness around, the grip upon, is a nightmare. And that applies to anything in the material world. It implies our relationship to human beings. It applies to ourselves and our relationship to life and death there. So, as human beings, we get ourselves into deep emotional, psychological, physical trouble through the holding on. That holding on may express itself as habits and addictions, which are painful and difficult. The holding on may show itself in holding on to another with the fear and the envy and the jealousies that may go on. Or holding on to a job or holding on to an idea or whatever. And that doesn't in any way imply at all any withdrawal from life. The withdrawal from life happens because there's too much pain in the holding on. That contributes to the alienation, the isolation, the separation. There's so much pain in the holding that people withdraw. They withdraw from life or withdraw from themselves. They withdraw from people because the pain is too much and the pain is related to the holding on. So it's a deep question, but it's a worthy question. It's a question worthy of our humanistic values. To be able to relate to life and look at and acknowledge the actuality, the truth, we might say, of this arising, staying and passing, this change there. And to see in all of that, can my being, so to speak, open up to learn to live with it and work with it and be comfortable with it and not fight it and not be afraid of it. And that will require from us quite a lot of inner work. And it is important to bear in mind here, and for me to repeat as well, it's not that those who don't hold to life or hold to this dynamic become cold and detached and indifferent. In fact, all the evidence, the experiential evidence, actually shows precisely the opposite. That those men and women of the earth, who are the gods of the earth, are those who have a relationship to life in which, because of the freedom from the non-clinging and the non-holding and the non-possessiveness, actually what comes out of that human being is a lot of love, a lot of deep friendship and kindness, a lot of offering and recognizing the freedom of others. And sometimes that freedom of others may show itself that they express the freedom to be with us. And if we're not clinging and not holding and not being possessive, then that human being, whoever she or he is, also has the freedom to be without us. And just earlier in the day, when we were, two of us here, were just talking together. And when, only a month ago, passed away. And in the periods of time, when good mother was a widow, and the brother and you, the two of you, Carol's brother and herself, went to live in America. The beautiful non-possessiveness, non-holding of allowing the children to go, even though she was left alone and elderly. And sometimes people, out of their love and the non-clinging holding, give support to the other through not being possessive. Allow people to come into our life and give them, because of the non-possessiveness, the freedom to leave. And it's as we know, it's a huge challenge there. And so when sometimes you and I, we've been in a relationship, lovers, partners, marriage, whatever the expression of the relationship may be, of course, naturally, there will be some sadness. It'd not be human. We experience sadness with change, with a death, with a loss, with a departure of the loved one. It doesn't mean to say that the love has to end. There's an enduring element about this love. So though a person may come into our life and leave our life, and though the person may leave us for another, But it's the non-clinging and the non-reactiveness, because we've looked at all of that, we don't want to live like that, this enduring element of the love. And some of us found, therefore, there can be a transition from the intimacy, the sexual, the erotic, the romantic, the passionate there, with all the love that can flow into that. And it can move because of change, because someone has left our life, or we have left his or her life. It can move into a friendship. It moves into a friendship because there isn't clinging. There isn't holding on to the past. There is the capacity for us to move on and move forward. And that communicates, it reminds us of what love is about and what a real freedom of life. So it would be useful, without too much thinking, please remember, it would be useful in the time that we are here. Are there any areas in our life which are painful and directly related to clinging and holding on? What would be a fresh attitude? What would be another way of looking? That surely would be worthy of some reflection there. And that question or that issue may arise for us quite spontaneously during the days. And therefore, if we put together the good meditation instructions to be present, to make skillful use of the breathing in and out, to remember that the breath is a reminder of the evolution of life. Why? It comes. It stays for a while in the being, and it goes. And it comes, and it stays in a while, and it goes. And experiences come into our life, stay for a while, and go. We come into this world, we stay for a while, and we go. And the recognition of that rhythm, natural organic rhythm of life, and the clarity that can come from it, can give us an inner peace in life, a calmness, which is not life denying, which is really connected with life, being true to the way it is, its unfoldment there, and we can be at peace with it, because we really have understood. It's the arising, the staying, and the passing. May all beings live in peace. May all beings live in harmony. May all beings live in peace and harmony.